Hey everyone, and welcome to No Planet B, where we're talking about climate change and its effect on planet A. I'm Wyatt.
And I'm Brianna. And in this episode, we'll be talking about sea level rise, who will be affected, and what's being done to prevent it.
Yeah, and this one was actually a really fun interview we got to do with a master's student at the University of Michigan, as well as a co-host of a radio show called It's Hot in Here, Aurora Aparicio. And it was a really fun interview. And yeah, here is that interview right now. We have a friend of mine and a master's student studying behavior education and communication at University of Michigan. This is Aurora Aparicio.
Hello.
Hi, Aurora. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Very good.
Thanks for having me on.
Of course. Thanks for taking the time to be on here. Today, we're talking about a topic that's super pertinent, especially to Florida residents and everyone around coastlines in general. This is sea level rise. Could you, if you had to, gun to your head?
Oh, no.
Already. Could you explain some of the main causes of sea level rise for someone who doesn't know them?
So with a gun to my head, I would say...
Two guns to your head now. You've wasted too much time.
Oh, no. this is a weak incentive here. So sea level rise is caused by, mainly from my understanding, two main things. So we have ice melt, which occurs from warming temperatures and just seasonal variations, as well as the thermal expansion of water. I think that like currently a lot of people are worried just about ice melt, and that's because it's become a more of a major player, just because our metrics for observing ice melt have gotten a little bit better, although they're still kind of weak, because it's just a little bit unpredictable. But so I'd say probably like maybe 60% is attributable to thermal expansion, which is just the process of liquid expanding as it heats up, as all most liquids do.
Yeah.
And ice melt would maybe more so contribute about 40-ish%. So yeah, that's what causes sea level rise globally. More regionally though, it kind of has to do with the shape of the ocean basins and like the ocean topography, like the seafloor topography created by different ocean gyres.
Yeah, I do remember a lot of people being confused by this idea of like, oh, sea level rise in New York is going to be a lot quicker than, you know, like the West Coast. And because it's like, you know, it's it's just one ocean. How could it be like different in different places?
So, and I had the same, I mean, we were literally talking about this in class this morning, and I couldn't really wrap my head around it. I was like, no, but it's water.
But it's water.
But it's water. And it just has so much more to do with like the Coriolis effect and different wind patterns and topography of the ocean. And actually, we learned today, this is so funny, it's like so fresh, but we learned today that as ice sheets melt, for example, Greenland, as that melts, it loses the mass that it had, which, you know, like if I went to Greenland and it lost mass, it's not like I would feel the difference in a gravitational pull, but it does affect how water moves. So as that ice sheet loses mass, it loses its gravitational pull, so water is pulled elsewhere.
Oh, geez.
Yeah, and it's typically like diametrically opposed. Like if you flattened out the Earth, JK, Earth's already flat.
It's already flat, though, I thought.
If you flattened out the Earth, it would actually, like, more of the gravitational pull would be, like, diagonal to Greenland.
And that also has to do with just, like, ocean topography, right? Like, literally just the shape of the ocean floor can affect.
Yeah, there's literally mountains, like, submerged under the ocean, and just, it's just, like, where the water sits. And that also has to do with, like, warmer regions have more thermal expansion. So Florida is going to have more thermal expansion than somewhere like New York, because it's closer to the equator and it's hotter.
That's a really good point. I actually hadn't thought about that. That's cool.
Did I get it? Is that sea level rise? I think
you got it. I think you nailed it.
So one of the questions that we had was,
if we stopped greenhouse gas emissions today, would sea level continue to rise? And I think this is like a really important question to be discussing, because recently there's been like questions of, oh, what we need to like stop emitting. And it, like with the new Green New Deal, they were talking about like hopefully within a few years getting to a carbon neutral like status. So if we stopped like within that amount of time, would sea level continue to rise?
Yeah. So, and I mean, I've been reading a lot about the Green New Deal as well. And we actually did a show on it last week. So their plan is really ambitious, and I really support it from a environmental perspective. But yeah, they do want to go carbon neutral within 10 years of its implementation. But as far as whether or not that will like immediately cut off sea level rise, the answer is no. And it's just simply because, and maybe it's important to just define greenhouse gases, but these are basically gases that are released from basic pollution, like tailpipes and different manufacturing processes, and they rise into the atmosphere, and they have this heat trapping capability, and so they basically just hold more heat and keep that within the atmosphere, because once they actually do hold those gases, they can no longer be released through, or once they do hold that heat, they can't be released through the radiative window of like the radiative envelope of our atmosphere. So basically within the atmosphere, they're pretty well mixed. There's like a uniform concentration for the most part, but that's not the case with the ocean. And it takes the ocean millennia to completely fully mix its heat and its gas concentrations. So the ocean holds like 93% of the Earth's like heat content, the incoming radiation. And so in order for that to be mixed through like colder deep waters and then warmer surface waters, it just takes a very long time. So if we stopped today, it would take, you know, God knows how long for sea level to completely stop. And I think it's important to distinguish like anthropogenic sea level rise from natural sea level rise, because our oceans have risen and fallen for the entire time Earth has been a thing.
Yeah.
So yeah, stopping emitting greenhouse gases would not stop sea level rise, but it would definitely mitigate it to the extent that, like, you know, we stop now and not 10 years from now. That would be a big difference, especially because our rates of emissions are exponentially increasing, and that causes exponential increases to the rates of sea level rise. So maybe like if we stop now, it would only rise like, you know, this is totally hypothetical, but maybe it would only rise like a foot. Whereas if we stopped in 20 years, it would rise like 10 times more than that, just because the effect is magnified by more pollution, more greenhouse gases, all that kind of stuff.
How do you think vulnerable populations will end up coping with sea level rise, especially in places like Florida, where there's a lot of dependence on coastal areas with like subsistence fishing populations, with like elderly populations, and just like low income areas?
Yeah, that's a great question. And my short answer is, for Florida, no, I don't think that legislation is happening fast enough and people are taking climate change seriously enough to for vulnerable populations and different industries and what AOC kind of defines as frontliner populations. I don't think it's going to happen for them. Not within a reasonable amount of time to where they like absolutely won't be affected. And I think that it's more, it's not so much like, or it's not even just their lives that are being kind of uprooted and shifted. It's like their cultures and you know, memories and generations of their family. I don't think it's happening fast enough.
Yeah, no, I agree. Like it's cultures, it's economies, it's a ton of things. I was reading the National Climate Assessment, or at least parts of it. Every once in a while I'll try busting into it because it's a giant document, but like I'll read a page or two every once in a while. And there was one that I thought was really interesting. In chapter 8, it talks about coastal effects. And there's a paragraph that I just totally hadn't considered before, and it was like the mental effects of either sea level rise or storms associated with sea level rise, like just different like catastrophes that can happen because of it and how that affects like anxiety, depression, PTSD. So it's like totally not just limited to economy or just limited to the idea of like, yeah, these people have to leave. It's like there's just a ton to it.
Yeah, and what's funny is, not really funny, it's actually kind of tragic, but we learned about epigenetics last semester in my ecology course and how different stressors in somebody's life, in say a mother's life, could cause, it could basically like write notes on her DNA that will be transferred to her baby. So if like she had elevated levels of cortisol because of stress, because of financial reasons and you know, not knowing what to do in order to find new housing or to be at work on time and avoid flooding, like her baby could experience those things too and have elevated levels of anxiety and depression. And it's more common or it's been more studied in smaller organisms, more basic organisms, I think, than humans, but it's definitely something that could happen. So I think that that's these mental things and these like physiological responses to stress, and which it's so real. Like the people without money or with less money, more vulnerable populations, like it's so sucky that they have to deal
with the scientific word
stress that people with more privilege and more money don't have to deal with.
Yeah.
That just sucks so bad.
Yeah. They're the people that definitely need like representing because they're not, sometimes they're not physically able to like represent themselves, or people aren't seeking out like the ability to represent them.
You know, with Miami, it's not just Florida is like kind of a, it's just a case study because not only is it, you know, 10% of the population living on the coast, it's also the fact that like Florida is made from limestone.
Yup.
And that's like Swiss cheese. Like water will just percolate up through the like natural ground. The natural ground as
the natural dirt.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The synthetic ground.
That's my favorite Radiohead song.
There's really no way to avoid flooding. There's like, I don't know if you guys have read about the king tides or like sunny day flooding in
Miami.
They
sound familiar.
But it'll be like a normal day, hasn't even rained, and there's like water coming up through people's shower drains.
Yeah. So I feel like that's one of the things we should talk about if you have anything to say, because like if we don't talk about it in the next 15 minutes, it's just going to be underwater. Like Miami, just like another thing in the National Climate Assessment was a photo that I've never seen before, which is them pumping water that's already flooding the streets into a canal in Miami.
Yeah.
I had no clue that that's like kind of already what they've been going through, that it's not like some future idea that they have to plan for, but it's something that they're currently mitigating.
Or trying to mitigate, right?
Trying to mitigate.
Miami was not designed... or it was not built with the future of sea level rise in mind, and it wasn't built with increases in greenhouse gas concentrations causing different levels of climate change across the globe in mind. As far as like what they're doing already, they're basically trying to elevate roads and to put in pumps and sewage drains and like bolster ecosystem services through things like I think they call it like blue carbon stores. So they're like basically wanting like mangroves and estuaries and different things like that to maintain sediments and store carbon in their big roots. And yeah, but I think what most politicians and what most people have in mind is kind of like a let's take Miami and push it somewhere else. I think that that's more of like what they're imagining happening. Not so much let's work with our ecology, let's work with our landscape architecture and like figure this out.
They're kind of like apocalyptic about it.
Yeah. And I don't know how feasible that is. Like, I don't know how long you can just like push people to the center and like hope that that city will survive.
So you wouldn't consider Miami resilient?
No. Okay.
I'm not like super familiar with Miami.
As like a Latin community, sure. As a community facing climate change, I really wouldn't. I think that I don't like mince my words when it comes to climate change. So like right now, no, it's not.
Yeah.
And I think they're trying to do things to mitigate it, but it's kind of too late. Like Miami will be underwater by the end of the century, I think. Or like severely displaced, but severely wet.
Severely wet, sure. At least.
Do you think they should be planning for the worst case scenario?
I mean, yeah, I think they're about to face it. I think Miami can be, it could be like a great example of what to do or what not to do when facing climate change for other, you know, mega cities. And I think that we'll have a lot to learn from what they do or don't do. And I don't want to make it sound like I'm apathetic to like Miami as a city. Like I have family there. I've spent a lot of time there. Like it's wonderful and crazy and fun.
Wonderful,
but
crazy, wet and wild. About to be more wet, unfortunately.
They have this mall that has like huge, a big, big slide that you like go down a sled on. And I got to go and I was like 20 when I went. Like what kind of... They still let me. Like, there was no height limit.
That's what you'd say about Miami, is that you went down a slide at a mall when you were 20 years old?
They don't care who you are. They'll let you go on the slide at the mall. So NOAA has this really cool tool. It basically, like, shows you any part of the world, and you can raise the sea level by, like, however many meters and, like, see what it looks like. I think people should be hella panicked about climate change. Like people need to be freaking out, and I think that's something, as much as, you know, building resilience and mitigating and adapting are important, you won't get people to do that if they're not actually worried. And newsflash, like people suck at thinking about climate change. People put like such high discount rates on the future, and they just, you know, like, oh, other people are going to deal with it, or I'm not seeing it in my everyday, so it doesn't really matter for me.
Yeah, there's just a record cold temperature.
My flooding every day, so it doesn't matter for me. That's a freak thing. You guys should fix your plumbing.
Hey, Aurora, do you want to talk about storms?
Oh, man, do I? Do I ever?
How exactly is sea level rise going to affect storms, do you think?
You said exactly, and I can't give you an exact answer. So what I can say is that tropical cyclones form over tropical and subtropical latitudes, and they're basically a function of like the evaporation and the temperature differential between the water and the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
And that causes a big, big storm with lots and lots of rain. But as we heat up water, which, like we said, sea level rise is caused by the warming of water and thermal expansion. And so as we heat up the surface water, basically those storms have more energy.
More fuel.
They got more fuel. They're taking diesel now.
Yeah, they're taking diesel and a lot more of it.
Guzzle it right up and dump it right down. So they have more energy. So like their wind speeds are partially a function of like how warm the water is. But also warm like warm air and like warmer clouds can hold more water before they dump it down, so there's more rain. And then, you know, if we're talking about flooding, not only do we already see flooding on sunny days, but it's like Florida doesn't have the infrastructure ecologically to manage all that flooding already. And as storms have gotten worse and worse, like property values on coastal housing, coastal real estate in Florida have risen. That doesn't make any sense. It's like, oh yeah, if we have a lot of insurance, if we have this like crazy web of insurance policies to protect your home from flooding and like storm surge or whatever, then you get to say that you have a big, strong, powerful house, and that makes the property more costly. Like that's a more expensive property now because it's big and strong, because it has a ton of insurance back behind it.
This tall, buff house that's ready for climate change is just going to cost more money.
Yeah, this house has guns.
Are there any studies? Is there anything coming out, like talking about the economic sort of damages and the effects of climate change? Mostly sea level rise, talking about like emergency response, property value, people getting their houses really buff, really tall to try to adapt, like the cost of moving and like how that's going to affect like smaller economies, larger economies around the whole state.
Yeah. So, I mean, as far as actual studies go, I don't have any like fresh off the top of the dome, but from what I can surmise is like Florida's economy is based on ecotourism, like some fishery stuff. People having like a lot of recreational stuff, and real estate. And so like as sea level rise happens, there's going to be changes in the way that fisheries work and changes in the way that people are able to go out and be on boats, maybe hopefully because of restrictions placed on boating and like the fuel you can use, or, you know, I don't know, different stuff like that. Adaptation is going to cost a lot of money. I think it's irresponsible to say that like we don't have that money. I think it's a matter of like reallocating funds to be where they need to be and to take climate change head on and react to it as the serious issue it is. As these stories are covered by the media, as these like climate change stories are covered by the media, it's like people aren't going to want to come to Florida. You're going to be like, no, that's where all the climate change is happening. I'm not going to go there. I think climate change and like the effects of negative ecosystem externalities are indicative of a poor economy. Like something's not being balanced out there, right? There's too many costs happening that aren't accounted for in the price of like fossil fuels. There's too many bad things that they do that people don't have to pay for at the pump.
Now, wait, what do you mean by that?
So I guess I mean like there are negative externalities that aren't, so say like particulate matter in the air, not really something we face in Florida, but the polluter doesn't have to pay for that, right? Like you don't have to pay to emit it, you just have to pay. You don't have to pay for the consequences of like asthma in somebody else's life. Mm-hmm. You don't have to pay their medical bill. You just have to pay for the gas. For climate change, we're not having to pay for the negative impacts of carbon. We just have to pay to use it.
Gotcha.
So it's like that cost isn't internalized in the cost we pay to use fossil fuels or to do other things that degrade the environment.
So you have like these negative effects of climate change that you're not really paying for, other than when you utilize them, you pay for them. Mm-hmm. And then that is kind of going to come back around to people who are going to suffer the consequences of climate change right away. Yeah. They're going to have some costs that they have to pay for, whether or not they utilize those things that caused climate change in the first place.
Exactly.
Which is kind of interesting. Also kind of bonkers.
Those vulnerable populations are going to be the ones that face the brunt of that. But that, I mean, that's why people are trying to get carbon taxes passed and or cap and trade programs to internalize that external cost of carbon and to make it more costly for producers to make it and more costly for consumers to use it. And there are a ton of, you know, consequences to that as well.
Yeah.
Like if, for example, in Ann Arbor, there's like a lack of housing here and rent is really high here. So people who come and work in Ann Arbor don't necessarily live here, and they either have to like drive here or take public transportation. So it's like, if you raise the price of gasoline, you're hurting the people that have to drive into town to go to work at a low paying job. And they're spending more of a percentage of their budget on gasoline than other people are. And that's not equitable. That's not fair. That's not just.
So maybe like a less depressing question. So we were talking earlier about how Miami isn't a resilient example of a city. Could you think of
not
any
yet
resilient examples aside from Miami?
You know, last semester I did a literature review. I was working with like a research group on climate resilience, and I really don't have an amazing example. And so when I read this question and like the prep questions, I was wondering what you guys had to say about it.
I did a report on the sustainability of Denver, but obviously Denver isn't like sea level rise isn't something that's going to directly affect them. And we're talking
more so like drought.
Yeah. And there are examples of resilient cities, but maybe not so much on the coast, because that's kind of something that's more impending.
Yeah, it's hard to think of one like good example.
One really good one.
One really fucking good one, because there are a couple like pretty good ones. Like I know, so Charleston, South Carolina has a plan right now for 50 years in the future based on sea level rise, which is kind of cool. And
that's
they've
great.
Set aside $235 million for drainage, which is pretty good. It's not necessarily something that's going to abet like climate change as a whole, but it's going to definitely help them and their residents. So in regards to sea level rise, and we've kind of touched on this a lot already, so I don't know exactly what else we're going to bring up. Cities that are going to be threatened by sea level rise pretty soon, what do you think their best way of being socially inclusive and being equitable, what do you think that looks like?
I think it is a little complex. I think at the same time, maybe it's more simple than people think it is. It just involves getting vulnerable populations at the table and not even getting them there, because it probably wouldn't take anything to get them there. It's inviting them and considering them and listening to their voices and actually hearing their concerns, not just, you know, having them present, but actually making them a part of creating legislation, creating policy, creating strategies that work best for them, because they're the people who understand how to best preserve their culture. And like all of us, they're facing climate change. And so, you know, it's a little prideful to step in and say, be like this prescriptive person and be like, this is what's going to work for your community. Like, how would you know? So I think it really just involves getting people, different stakeholders, to sit around the table and actually listen to one another. And maybe that involves not only getting them around a conference table, but maybe all going out for drinks and actually talking about other things that they can relate on other than climate change, to kind of break down those barriers that we so naturally have when we're in front of people that we either have a prior judgment on or just like think are bad. Like if you sat me down across somebody like the CEO of BP, I'd probably be pissed. But if we went out to drinks and you didn't tell me what he was, like I would see more humanity in that person. And I think it involves, you know, actually bonding as humans and actually listening to one another.
We get them all together. We don't
round them up.
Don't tell them who's who. like a murder mystery party.
It's a blind date.
It's a blind date for 17 people. Get them all a little bit drunk and just get everyone to listen to each other.
Yeah, but I mean, get people to start talking about their kids, get people to start talking about things that they value, and make it relevant to that community, those people, those stakeholders. Because climate change is affecting all of us. I think we just need to be attuned to how and how to address that in a sensitive way rather than being prescriptive.
There's nothing funny about climate change and about sea level rise.
Oh, man.
However, so this is our first episode. We don't have any listeners yet. So, wow. But I did ask some social media, some outlets, if they had to ask someone questions about sea level rise, what they would ask. And so I'm going to go ahead and toss a couple softballs at you. Okay. First question related. And this, the context of this is that I said, if you have a question about sea level rise, what would it be? Mm-hmm. Question number one, why is the rent too damn high though? Which is funny, but also like we did kind of just talk about how that is relevant.
Yeah, because they're trying to pull a fast one. I don't know. They're basically everyone's trying to show how like the houses have been in the gym and they've been getting buff and swole and working out, and they have like mad medical insurance behind them, and that's why the rent's too damn high.
That's why the rent's too damn high, is because these houses are really buff, really ready for climate change.
They're so not. Full disclosure, they're not ready.
I can't stress that enough. At all.
Your house on stilts is not ready.
Question two from social media says, and this is specifically from Instagram, I don't know if that's important or not, will Florida be consumed by the Gulf and die, or will it become the new Atlantis?
You know, I never really thought about it like that, and I think we need to redo the whole episode now.
Talking about...
Because I have a whole new different perspective on it.
You've just readapted. Let me change gears. We can re-record this whole episode.
My code has been cracked, and I'm a whole different person now.
What will we do when the mermen attack? Aurora, what is your plan for that? And
we could severely slow them down with like Doritos Locos Tacos.
What are you talking about?
They won't be ready for it. They won't be ready. And I don't think that, you know, as far as anatomy goes, pretty sure mermen don't have buttholes. don't know where they're gonna store all that Doritos Locos Tacos.
I see what
or
you're
get
saying.
Rid of it. So
biological warfare is the first thing you jump to.
I don't mess around.
Here's one that's going to be, I think, answerable, because I think you did mention this earlier. Is it too early to panic?
No. Never too early. My motto is never too early to panic. Grad school...
That's what anxiety sounds like.
Trains you. Yeah, grad school trains you for that real good. always be panicking all the time. No, I don't think... I don't necessarily... If panic motivates you, great. If it doesn't, do something else to motivate you.
Yeah, I think that's one of the big like difficulties in motivating people, is because if they're not in a vulnerable area, they kind of have no reason to panic right now. And that's like a really tough motivator is when.
And I think that's like that's the discrepancy, right? Is like you don't feel like you're feeling the effects. Like you don't notice that you're feeling the effects, and it's probably because you're not really, it hasn't been made clear to you like how it will affect you. And I think that's something that climate scientists struggle with, is like, how will climate change affect somebody who lives, like we were saying earlier, in Colorado, or like someone who isn't on a coastal city? Like, it's relevant to everyone. We just have to find a way to make it apparent to them.
So I think we're going to end it on this question.
Okay.
This is a political one, charged one. If I can't find my trunks, can I swim in my pants?
I was waiting for it and it never came. Like,
I
don't know. Like,
I think that depends on the quality of your pants, but okay. I also think that I'm confused about why you can't find your trunks if you live in Florida.
Yeah, that's a...
You can't find them because
right
you're probably
there.
Wearing them. You're looking at everywhere other than your hips, which is where they're sitting right now. You're in your trunks.
Oh, no.
Okay. Well, thank you for being here with us, Aurora. So this has been episode 1 of No Planet B. Again, I'm Wyatt.
I'm Brianna.
And thank you for listening. Wow, what an episode that was that we all heard together and listened to together. If you want to check out Aurora's radio show that we mentioned at the beginning, it's actually at www.hotinhere.us. They release an episode, I believe, every like Sunday or Monday every week.
Thanks for that shameless plug, Wyatt.
Thank you. No shame.
No shame here. Speaking of things that are getting hot in here, our Insta handle.
Holy
No Planet B FSU. If you want to give us a follow, you won't be disappointed. We're going to have all the content that you came there for.
And if you want to check out any of our references or the websites associated with the episode you just listened to, you can check out our Twitter at No Planet B Cast. That's No Planet B Cast. On the website, twitter.com. You all know where it is. And thanks for listening. It means so much. Have a good rest of your car ride, probably.
Or not. Take a bus or bike, because no Planet B, bro.
Yeah, we'll end on that, because that was worth it.